The headlines this hour. Top U.S. Republicans support President Trump's efforts to challenge presidential election results, despite the lack of evidence of significant fraud. The scuffles erupt in Peru where supporters of President Martin Vizcarra take to the streets to protest against his impeachment of Congress. And Asian markets rise for a second day in hopes of progress on a possible vaccine for COVID-19 that has battered the world economy. Thanks for joining us. In the U.S., top Republicans, including the Senate Majority Leader, have supported President Donald Trump's efforts to challenge election results.
And the courts are here to work through concerns. Our institutions are actually built for this. We have the system in place to consider concerns, and President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
McConnell added that he had met with Attorney General William Barr about the issue. Barr has already given federal prosecutors the green light to pursue allegations of voting irregularities across the U.S. That came after Trump's campaign unveiled a lawsuit against election officials in Pennsylvania, following similar suits in several other states. The campaign has, without providing any evidence, alleged that Pennsylvania's mail-in voting system lacked the transparency that in-person balloting had. Trump has said he lost the election to his Democratic rival Joe Biden due to fraud, but has offered no evidence for his claim.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence.
Joe Biden has won. Trump may contest it, but the evidence is there. There is no illegal things regarding vote. The system has worked, and it will continue. One man will not ruin this system for us. Joe Biden is now our president.
And one thing I want to add, it's not Republican versus Democrat. It's we are Americans.
Special about our country.
Period.
But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. Pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. says the lawsuit brought by President Trump's campaign against U.S. election officials is likely to be thrown out due to a lack of evidence.
A lot of these cases that he's filed so far, he hasn't had a very good track record with them. They've been thrown out because he doesn't have the evidence. A lot of these admissions or allegations are self-anecdotal. They are the They are the narratives of other people just trying to say that they've seen something when they may not have. And I think what judges are looking for is tangible evidence, concrete evidence that there's massive voter fraud here. What's in addition to this, even if there are cases of voter fraud, unless it's on a widespread, massive scale, the amount of votes that the former vice president has, the president's rival, Joe Biden, has, in comparison to what he has, it really wouldn't change the outcome. It would maybe be a few votes here and there, even if it's 1,000 here and 1,000 there, it's not going to overturn the multiple thousands or tens of thousands that he's been, that Biden has outdistanced the president collectively.
The UN has criticized the U.S. over a host of issues related to its human rights record. In a session dubbed Universal Periodic Review, the UN Human Rights Council raised the issues of police brutality, racial discrimination, and mistreatment of migrants in the U.S. under the administration of President Donald Trump. Several member states also called on the U.S. to reverse the decision to withdraw from the UN rights body and to end sanctions on members of the International Criminal Court. The council expressed hope that the next U.S. administration would work to roll back what it called Trump's harmful policies. All UN members undergo the review every 4 to 5 years. Monday marked Washington's third review since the year 2015. Political activist Life Malcolm says that the U.S. disregards international laws as well as UN recommendations on human rights.
In 2011, the United States, the UPR, had a review of the United States for similar things. They called it then systemic racism, and they mentioned the brutal tactics that the United States impose on African people here through their police force all the time. But the United States consistently disregards these recommendations by the United Nations and the UPR. So while it's good that the United Nations UPR makes these recommendations, what's clear is the United States is a dictatorship that rules without regard for law. I mean, it's interesting, this go around, they called it, you know, the United Nations and the UPR attempts to attribute what's occurring here now to the Trump administration. But as I just mentioned, in 2001, Donald John Trump wasn't the president, it was George W. Bush in 2009, and in 2015, in 2011, I think I mentioned that year too, it was Barack Hussein Obama who was the president. And now this thing is happening with Trump. So it's not whoever's in the White House, it's the United States itself.
Scuffles have erupted in Peru's capital, Lima, where supporters of President Martin Vizcarra rallied to protest against his impeachment in Congress. Police in riot gear tried to push back angry protesters gathering at the iconic site of the Plaza San Martin. The protesters shouted slogans to denounce the impeachment trial. Peruvian lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to remove the popular president over corruption allegations. Vizcarra said that he will accept the motion, but he categorically rejected accusations of taking bribes from companies that won public works contracts. The head of Congress is expected to assume power on Tuesday. Manuel Merino will remain in office until the end of the current term in July 2021. The presidential election will be held next year in April. Markets in Asia have rallied following news of progress in the development of a vaccine for COVID-19 that has battered the world economy. Tokyo, Hong Kong, Sydney, and Jakarta all rose more than 1% on Tuesday. Singapore and Manila surged over 3%. There were also modest gains in Seoul, Shanghai, and Wellington. The strong performance was led by companies including airlines, which have been hammered for most of the year by the virus lockdowns. The gains in Asian markets followed the positive lead overnight from the U.S. and Europe. Hopes for an end to the pandemic has risen after a U.S. pharmaceutical giant and its German partner said Monday their vaccine was more than 90% effective in preventing infection. Political commentator Andrew Loewing believes that there is no guarantee that markets will continue to rise in the coming weeks following their latest gains in the wake of good news on a COVID vaccine.
For the market has been in the doldrums for too long, and everybody's waiting for some sort of good news. Let's not forget that this vaccine, even though it's a kind of breakthrough, is still 90%, not 100% effective. So it remains to be seen whether it's going to pass all the hurdles. And secondly, even if it has passed all the hurdles, it's a question of how many people are going to receive the vaccine, bearing in mind, first of all, to what extent the supply will be able to meet the global demand. And secondly, I think that the chances are that the vaccine will be geared towards protecting all the paramedics, you know, the nurses, the frontline medical staff. But nevertheless, it is a welcome news. And obviously, as I said, that the market has been waiting for something like this for a long time. But let's beware of too much euphoria. And then let's not, the market is only registered, you know, 1 or 2% maximum at the moment. So it's a kind of cautious optimism. But apart from the vaccine, there's also the question of the seeming to be the end of the U.S. presidential election, ending some of the uncertainty.
Taliban militants in Afghanistan have called on U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to stay committed to an agreement to withdraw American troops from the war-torn country. The Taliban said the agreement is the most effective tool to end the Afghan war. The militant group signed the deal with the Trump administration in February. The agreement sets the full U.S. withdrawal as a precondition for a Taliban ceasefire with the Afghan government. Washington has promised to pull all forces out of Afghanistan by May 2021, but NATO has ruled out an early exit, saying that it hinges on the security situation. Violence has surged there over the past months, despite the U.S. deal. Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan says that he has reached an agreement with Russia and Azerbaijan to end the fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Pashinyan says that he took the decision after deep analysis of the military situation. However, he said the move had been, quote, unbelievably painful. The announcement sparked outrage in the Armenian capital, Yerevan. Thousands there gathered outside of the government headquarters to call for Pashinyan's resignation. Groups of protesters also stormed the government headquarters and the parliament building. The ceasefire is being overlooked by some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers. The Azerbaijani president says Turkey will also be involved in implementing the truce. Three previous ceasefires failed to end the fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh. Political commentator Pablo Gonzalez says that the agreement to end the war in the Nagorno-Karabakh region amounts to a military victory for Azerbaijan.
This ceasefire seems clearly like the end of the war with the victory of Azerbaijan with the support of Turkey. This ceasefire, if they what we know as the main points of these agreements is what Baku wanted. So they recovered big areas of the Karabakh region. It was their main goal. And now they allow the peacekeepers to be in the region. So for them, it's the perfect situation. Also, they will have now access since the by land to the Nakhichevan region. So it is something that they will never expect before. So they have one of the part, they have all the things that they wanted, and the other part, the part that lost, that is Armenia Artsakh, they need to sign that to don't lose more.
Moving on, thousands of Georgians have hit the streets of the capital Tbilisi for a second day to back opposition calls for a rerun of last month's parliamentary election. Police have detained some protesters. The opposition and protesters who defied a COVID-19 curfew claimed that the election was rigged. Police used water cannon outside of the Central Election Commission where protesters had gathered. There were also reports of police firing tear gas towards protesters. Police denied that report. During protests on Sunday, dozens of people were also injured. Britain's unemployment rate has risen in the third quarter of the year as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to hit the jobs market there. The UK's Office for National Statistics says that the unemployment rate jumped to 4.8% in the 3 months of September. It says a record high of 314,000 workers were made redundant in that period. The figure was up by 181,000 compared with the second quarter of the year. Finance Minister Rishi Sunak says that the figures underline the scale of the challenges that Britain is facing. The country has been forced to impose strict lockdown measures to contain the virus that has hit its economy hard. Fears have been raised about the global economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic could trigger new security threats, potentially leading to World War III. Maybe in preparation for such a scenario, Britain's military is asking for the Treasury to enable long-term investments needed to modernize. Meanwhile, the UK is selling billions of pounds worth of arms, regardless of the human rights records of some of its customers. Bianca Rahimi has more.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernising and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter.
Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come, and this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And that time is fast approaching when indeed the British government, as indeed other governments, are going to have to start doing the mathematical reckoning for their spending. And so I think possibly what's a motive here for General Carter as head of the UK Armed Forces to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochran, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
Loves the game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist.
Controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win at all cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all. He
got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest
lie, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed. Yeah. I revel in your hatred. Because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all of the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news, but I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe he'd be a good one.
It just gave
me the chills.
And horrifying. What about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but has been involved in countless campaigns. But also, we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush. And then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate. But actually, this has been in the works. So.
Years in the making. Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse. I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric, and he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure, and you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This is what was so useful about this film, was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment, and that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon, and we see this through the film when they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump. We see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized, and it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. Mm-hmm. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way? And is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, a hollowing out of politics. The establishment, there's been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone that he's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced. And so he's tapping into the majority of people the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this, this is the such a worrying thing, is his policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows, roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with and Manny Fadu, we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up, because we're about to go to him just now. So just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years, I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, when he denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea that Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that, where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and it's not, they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he flashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
He knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who is the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's, you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
because it's
and
just
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But surely that would
discredit part of this,
Trump.
He's
yes.
part of this, and he's it's again, it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
yeah, that is a very interesting point. And yeah. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stone's where he said the NBC's, the CNN, actually, they're marginalised now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but are becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme centre. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives us a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far-right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, and that is I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that. The work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a big impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is this merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going
to
win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam by Tahir Reza Jafar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Welcome to another episode of For Humanity, a program in which we look at the beautiful treatise of rights from Imam Zainul Abidin عليه السلام. And we find that in this treatise of rights, the Imam has mentioned the rights and responsibilities of every individual we may encounter in our daily lives. We are currently discussing the rights of the mas'ul, haqqul mas'ul, that is the person who is asked, the person who is approached by beggars in order to beg, in order to ask from him. And just as the beggar himself, the sa'il, the asker, has rights, the one who is being asked also has certain rights. We know that there has been a lot of emphasis and a lot of encouragement given to charity and to giving people, helping people with one's wealth. But at the same time, there has been equal emphasis to avoid begging. This is a very important aspect that we need to discuss. Of course, we are talking about the right of the one who is asking, but we should realize that even the one who is being asked may one day turn to a position where he has to ask. So it is important for us to realize that while Islam encourages giving and charity, it discourages begging and asking. To this end, we find, for example, many traditions have reached us. One tradition states, Al-mas'alatu miftahul faqr. Begging and asking others for help is the key to poverty. A person should not think that by asking other people that you will obviously become richer. No, once you get into the habit of begging and asking, you are actually unlocking the door of poverty and you will end up becoming more poor and lose your wealth by this action of depending on others and asking others. In one tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, As-su'alu yud'ifu lisan al-mutakallim wa yaksiru قلب الشجاع البطل ويوقف الحر العزيز موقف العبد الذليل ويذهب بهاء الوجه ويمحق الرزق. Here you find that Imam Ali alayhi salam is mentioning all the negative consequences of asking, of begging, of depending on others, of seeking from others. He says, asking others has certain negative consequences, the first of which is it makes a person weak. It weakens the speech of the person. يُضْعِفُ لِسَانَ الْمُتَكَلِّمِ. The speaker who is asking for something, that person cannot speak with confidence. He trembles. He is scared as he begs because he knows that one wrong word from him would remove any hope of attaining what he seeks from the person whom he is asking. So he is asking with a lot of fear and this weakens him. The second is وَيَكْسِرُ قَلْبَ الشُّجَاعِ الْبَطَلِ. When a person is even courageous and heroic, still, when he has to ask somebody for something, then it breaks his heart because now you are lowering yourself in front of someone else. You are putting yourself in a position where someone else is higher than you. So even if you are a courageous and heroic individual, still, the moment you have to ask for something, you have to beg for something, then you are breaking your heart and you are breaking that courage that you have within you. That is the second negative consequence. The third is, وَيُوقِفُ الْحُرَّ الْعَزِيزِ مَوْقِفَ الْعَبْدِ الذَّلِيلِ. It turns the respected free person into one who is like an abased slave. One who is like a lowly slave. So, you know, obviously in the society at the time of the Prophet and the A'imma alayhim as-salam, people were of two kinds. There were free people and there were slaves. The slaves were those who had no volition and they had no choice in the way they lived their lives. They had to live as their masters dictated to them. And so a slave was somebody who had no control over his own destiny, over his own life. And many times, therefore, slaves yearned for freedom and they tried in different ways to earn their freedom. And so once a slave was freed, that was the biggest achievement he or she could attain in their life. So freedom has great value. The Imam alayhi salam says that when you beg from someone, when you ask someone for assistance, then you, even if you are a free person with your own dignity and respect, the moment you beg, the moment you ask, you turn into someone who is like a slave, a lowly slave. Because now you have put yourself in a position where someone else has power over you. That person can either give you what you need or can deprive you and leave you suffering as you are. And so this is the third negative consequence of begging or asking. The fourth is, وَيُذْهِبُ بَهَاءَ الْوَجْهِ. And when you beg, when you ask, the dignity that you have dissipates. Now you no longer have any respect or dignity because you are degrading yourself by asking someone else. And finally, وَيَمْحَقُ الرِّزْقِ. When you ask, you lose your sustenance. A person who begs others loses his rizq. His rizq, his sustenance becomes less. It reduces. Why? Because one of the ways of increasing one's sustenance is by depending solely upon Allah Azza wa Jal, by having faith and trust in Allah Azza wa Jal. When you have trust in Allah, the Quran also says, وَمَنْ يَتَوَكَّلَ عَلَى اللَّهِ فَهُوَ حَسْبُهُ. Whoever has complete trust in Allah, Allah is sufficient for that person. But now when you put your trust and your dependence on someone else, then your sustenance reduces. So these are the negative consequences of asking. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal to grant us the ability to avoid asking others. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity by Brother Taher Reza Jafar. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah, Muhammad is His messenger.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com IRIB.org/EN. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.